In 2018, the drought in Cape Town, South Africa was so bad that nothing but muddy water came out of the city's faucets.
The residents would go and collect their daily supply of 7 gallons of water every day, 7 gallons of water per person per day.
So the scientists at a nonprofit proposed a solution that worked with nature instead of against it. All they needed was a helicopter and an army of women with chainsaws.
Those areas are very mountainous. They are very high. It's high areas.
And here's the crazy thing. It worked. I'm David Pogue, and this is Unsung Science.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Season 1, Episode 10, How Women with Chainsaws Saved Cape Town. That would be Cape Town, South Africa, a rapidly growing city of 4.7 million people. The continent of Africa looks like a dog's head, nose down, like it's drinking from a bowl. Well, it looks like that if you squint and you haven't had much sleep. There's even a lake where the eye should be, Lake Victoria. Anyway, Cape Town is on the southernmost tip of South Africa on the west side. It's basically the dog's mouth. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous city. I mean, it's parked right at the union of two oceans, and it's bordered by majestic mountains. From the air, it looks like a CGI city somebody made for a Lord of the Rings sequel or something. Anyway, like everywhere else on Earth, Cape Town has been feeling the effects of the climate crisis. The city's water comes from its mountains. In the winter, it rains, and the water runs down the slopes into 6 huge reservoirs. In 2014, the reservoirs were in great shape, 97% full. But that year's rainy season was a not very rainy season. The reservoirs fell to 71% full. Could this be anything to worry about? 2016, another dry rainy season. Now the reservoirs are 60%. Uh-oh. 2017, 38% full. That got people's attention, especially when that summer was baking hot and brutally dry. The city logged 6 inches of rain over the entire year 2017. That's only 2 inches more rain than the Sahara Desert gets. The news wasn't good.
Last year was one of the driest on record here in the midst of a 3-year drought that officials say was impossible to predict.
By the beginning of 2018, the reservoirs were below 20% full. The biggest one, the Tiewaterskloof Reservoir, usually supplies about half of the city's water. It was about 12% full. You can find pictures on Google. It looked like a huge, gross, sandy mud puddle with these naked branches sticking up from what had once been the underwater floor. And keep in mind that at about 10%, the reservoirs are basically worthless. The dregs of that water are too muddy to be useful. Cape Town was becoming the first major city in the world to run out of water. The countdown had begun to a scenario called Day Zero, when you'd turn on the faucet and nothing would come out.
So the city has entered a phase where it is anticipated the real possibility
of day zero.
Nobody could talk about anything else.
The projection is that Cape Town will run out of water sometime early in April. That means you have to save water as if your life depends on it.
This is Helen Zilla, Premier of the Western Cape District, in a 2018 news broadcast.
There are fears of anarchy and chaos as people, of course, begin the scramble for water. Have you talked about how that will be managed?
Yes, absolutely. There's a safety and security plan involving the Metro Police, involving the police, involving private security and the South African National Defence Force.
If anyone understands Cape Town's water situation, it's Louise Stafford. She's the director of source water protection in South Africa for the Nature Conservancy. She'd spent decades studying and managing water use in Cape Town, but she'd never witnessed anything like this.
Agriculture was really affected quite badly. Many farmers lost their farms, and over 33,000 people lost their jobs on farms in the Western Cape or in this region. They have extended families. It's whole households that's being affected.
So what did it feel like among the residents?
There was elements of people saying this is a conspiracy theory. Then you get portions of the communities that felt really fearful with that reality. The majority of residents in Cape Town really was really concerned about it.
As of February 1st, 2018, you weren't allowed to use more than 13 gallons of water per person per day. 13 gallons to cover everything. Drinking, cooking, showering, laundry, toilets, dishes, pets, everything. Get caught using more than that and you'd be slapped with fines up to $700. And if you had trouble even getting water, well, the government was happy to help out.
The residents would go and collect their daily supply of 7 gallons of water every day, 7 gallons of water per person per day. There were about 200 pods, what they call pods, those temporary places. It's almost like little gas stations where we would have to queue every day to get our daily supply of water.
Standing in those queues to fill up your water jug every day wasn't just inconvenient. It was a major disruption to your day.
In addition, you know, children need to get to school, people need to get to work, and now you have to queue for your daily supply of water.
If you live in the U.S., you've probably grown up taking water for granted. You consider it basically free. I mean, if you tell someone from, like, Kenya that we take thousands of gallons of filtered, purified, chlorinated, fluoridated drinking water and water our lawns with it and flush our toilets with it, they'll say you're crazy. But during the Day Zero episode in South Africa, water became incredibly precious.
It became a status symbol to have a dirty car because it shows that you're complying and you are not wasting water. We couldn't water our gardens. Many people just lost their lawns.
Radio and TV ads offered tips to save water.
We only flush after every 3 peas in our house.
I make sure to boil just one cup of water instead of filling the kettle to the max.
I save water
by not doing the dishes. If you lick the plates clean, then they look clean, then you can use them again.
Water is a limited resource, so we should all be aiming high to save it.
To take a shower, you'd stand in a plastic bin to catch your runoff. Later, you could lift up the bin, carry it over to the toilet, and use it for flushing. You didn't use soap and water to wash your hands. You used hand sanitizer. Women got shorter haircuts, so they'd need less water to rinse out the shampoo. If police caught you washing your car with municipal water, they'd hit you with a fine and they'd confiscate your hose and your buckets so you couldn't do it again. Pop singers recorded free 2-minute versions of their hits, just long enough for the 2-minute showers the government encouraged citizens to take.
Sure you're tired of the same old stories, but I need you around, wouldn't be the same with.
This YouTube video from The Guardian profiled more citizen tactics.
Okay, so we had to take all the grass on. And this is a plastic grass, which has become very common in the neighborhood and everywhere. Plants that require water is just a no-no.
If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, let it
drown. Yeah, that. It's a mess. It's terrible. I hate it.
In the end, Day Zero didn't refer to one particular day. It referred to the whole period of desperate restrictions and panic. It lasted for about 6 months. And then, finally, finally, it rained. The restrictions had made the water last just long enough for the rains to start refilling the reservoirs. Here's Louise again.
And it started raining that winter, so we received 70% of the rain, so it brought that relief. So it's a combination of water savings, more aware of water, rainy seasons.
The city of Cape Town celebrated with TV ads.
It was tough, but together we refused to waste water. Now we're the number one water-saving city in the world. Come and see for yourself. It might just change the way you think about water.
But Louise says that Cape Town's water emergency still isn't over.
We cannot say that the crisis ended, because since 2018, not one of the years, not one of the winters, Cape Town had its 100% rainfall. It's on average between 70 and 80% of our annual rainfall that we had since 2018. That's the first thing that we should know. The second thing is that the population in Cape Town increases. The population is growing.
The Cape Town drought was the worst in 100 years. But everybody knows that it won't be the last. Even during the Day Zero episode, city leaders held urgent meetings to consider ways to avoid another crisis. They launched construction of 2 desalinization plants designed to convert seawater into drinking water. They began digging deeper to reach even more remote aquifers, underground water stores. And even before the crisis was over, they were meeting with the Nature Conservancy, the nonprofit environmental charity where Louise Stafford works. The Conservancy had a crazy idea that could win Cape Town more water every year, cheaply and perpetually, using a method that worked with nature instead of against it. All they needed was a helicopter, some ropes and saws, and some of the poorest women in Cape Town. After the break, I'll tell you about it, and I'll tell you whether it worked.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And one more plug here. I'm the author of a book called How to Prepare for Climate Change. It's a 600-page paperback that's designed to be a field guide to the new climate. It tells you where to live, where to invest, what to grow, how to reinforce your home, how to insure, how to talk to your kids, and how to ride out wildfires, hurricanes, heat waves, and so on. If you live in a state whose name contains a vowel, then you've been affected by climate change already, and you should check out this book to protect your health, your family, your home, and your finances. It's How to Prepare for Climate Change, the book that's exactly what it sounds like. As you now know, the 4.7 million people who live in Cape Town, South Africa, get their water from the mountains around the city. The water runs down and eventually flows into six giant reservoirs that by February 2018 were essentially empty.
We were quite panicking. I don't want to lie to you.
That's Tandeka Maifi Rafu, who lives in a small town near Cape Town.
You would open your tap and then you would get water that smells muddy. Sometimes the color of the water, you would see that it's brown, meaning that it's coming straight from the bottom of the river or the dam. So it was really a difficult time for us, really.
And that's Asipe Setiwayo. I'll tell you what Tandeka and Asipe are doing in this story in just a moment. Anyway, the first solutions that occurred to Cape Town's engineers were what environmentalists call gray infrastructure, stuff you build, like desalinization plants, pipelines, deep drilled wells to aquifers. But Louise Stafford raised her hand to propose a different approach, green infrastructure, work with nature instead of against it. To understand the gist of the idea, we need to shift our focus from the city of Cape Town to the magnificent sandstone peaks surrounding it. These mountains draw a million tourists a year, but they're also host to a remarkable ecosystem called Fynbos. That's F-Y-N-B-O-S, loosely translated from Afrikaans as fine bush. It's a narrow belt of incredibly diverse plant life, spectacular weird flowers, shrubs, grasses that give the mountain a sweet, herby smell. According to Louise, the Fynbos is really something special.
It's got about 9,500 different plant species. Over 70% of those plants are found nowhere else on Earth.
As a handy bonus, the Fynbos isn't very thirsty.
Because it evolved over time for this environment, it also lives with the environment. It doesn't take too much water, and it's in balance.
But something else grows on the mountain slopes around Cape Town, something that shouldn't be there. Ominous music, please. Thank you. Those mountains have been pretty much taken over by an invasive species that might not strike you as especially evil. Pine trees. Back in the 1800s and early 1900s, European colonists brought pines and acacia trees to Cape Town and grew them in plantations. They couldn't very well build their homes and repair their ships with Fynbos shrubs, so they set about growing their own timber. But in the process, they triggered a classic story of unintended consequences, an invasive species running wild.
It's human-induced. They arrive there without natural enemies. And that gives them a competitive advantage because they can grow without any predators or insects that eat them or pathogens. So what happens is that the pine trees escape from the plantations and it started growing up high up in the mountainous areas.
These pines have huge root systems. They're incredibly thirsty trees. A single tree can drink 400 gallons of water a day. 400 gallons. Remember, the people down below were trying to get by on 13 gallons a day.
If it rains, the pine tree roots take that water up and it evaporates and it doesn't allow the water to get into the streams.
So the trees are stealing the water up high in higher elevations, mountains, before it can reach the city?
Yeah, the invasive tree steals the water from high up in the mountains and from lower-lying areas where they would infiltrate aquifers and replenish the rivers.
Louise and the Nature Conservancy put together a public-private partnership. a coalition of environmental groups, government departments, and corporate donors called the Greater Cape Town Water Fund. Its proposal to the city was simple but incredibly ambitious. Hit undo on the 150-year-old pine tree mistake. Cut them all down.
Looking at the trees is a science that's been coming for a long time. We always knew that invasive trees steal water. But what is new is the urgency, the fact that the dams and the reservoirs ran dry. The urgency and the realization changed.
What was the hardest part of getting this to happen?
The hardest part was to convince a city that was facing a situation of taps running dry to think beyond the short term of getting of a rainy season and of pipes and reservoirs, but to think that nature can become part of the solution.
So the hardest part wasn't the engineering or getting people into rough, dangerous, mountainous areas to cut down trees. It was the people part, the political part. You make it sound like anybody would need to be convinced. I mean, who wouldn't want an inexpensive nature-based solution compared with building a desalinization plant?
I think the reason why is because the figures aren't there. A municipal manager or a municipal water utility, their main function is to make sure that the taps are open. And it's mostly run by engineers.
How do you convince engineers, whose first instinct is to build stuff, that the better, cheaper, longer-lasting solution is to cut down stuff? You meet them on their own turf, with surveys and research. In 2018, the Greater Cape Town Water Fund conducted a study.
We said, if we clear the invasive trees in certain areas, how quickly can we get the water back in the system and at what cost? And the business case, I believe, was a game changer.
The study revealed an astonishing statistic. Within 5 years of clearing the invasive trees, the city would gain over 13 billion gallons of water every single year.
The city would gain 2 months' water supply every year if we clear 137,000 acres. 2 months' water supply every year into perpetuity for as long as we maintain the areas.
And by 2050, keeping the invasive trees cleared would gain the city of Cape Town 4 months of water every year. And I'm guessing that this is the part that caught the eye of the city engineers, the price.
Cutting down 30 invasive trees has shown a return on investment of 351%. In other words, it's 351% more cost effective to clear invasive trees from the watershed than it is to set up and manage and operate the desalination plant.
As a handy bonus, clearing the trees is a more or less permanent fix. As long as you stop by every couple of years for a little cleanup, Louise says that
it will carry on forever. Whereas if you look at engineered infrastructure, they have reservoirs have a lifespan, pipes have a lifespan. So one always have to, you know, maintain or rebuild.
Did nobody say, wait a minute, this is the first time in history that the Nature Conservancy is suggesting cutting down a lot of trees?
We understand that it's important to have trees to help with carbon sequestration and mitigate climate change. But if you have the wrong tree or the right tree in the wrong area, in other words, a tree that doesn't evolve in an area and become invasive, the cost of having that tree in a watershed outstrips the benefit. Where we remove trees, we allow the native vegetation to restore. And by doing that, you enhance the environment and the natural environment rather than looking at it just simply removing trees.
Now, you might consider cutting down 250 square miles of pine forest on steep, dangerous mountain slopes in blazing heat and whipping winds to be a fairly ambitious project. But Louise and her team decided to make it just a little more ambitious yet. And to understand the significance of this part, we have to acknowledge a particular dubious distinction held by South Africa. On the list of the world's countries sorted by wealth inequality, South Africa is in first place, or dead last, depending on how you look at it. Until 1994, of course, South Africans lived under the legal and political system called apartheid. Official racial segregation and economic discrimination for the benefit of the white population. Strict laws literally dictated separate neighborhoods for each skin color. If you were black, you lived in what are called townships, very poor, ramshackle, crowded neighborhoods on the outskirts of town. Apartheid ended 27 years ago, but the townships are still there. Each neighborhood does have running water now, a single public spigot out by the road. They have toilets, too. One porta potty for each dozen families or so. Now you have the context for the choice of workers that Louise and her team chose for the tree cutting project.
We target women and young people under 25. And through creating these job opportunities, we improve livelihoods, we help alleviate poverty, we give additional skills and dignity to people who don't have work.
That's right. The plan was to hire women, poor women from the city, to do the work.
So the added benefit of the work that we do is job creation and poverty alleviation.
Wasn't that considered an added complication to an already complicated project because you're hiring people who have no experience in forestry?
But people are highly trained. We make sure that safety is first, and we're really very excited about this opportunity that's been created for small businesses and for women.
Here's where Tendeka and Asipe come in. They were among the workers hired to undertake the tree cutting on Cape Town's mountainous slopes.
When I started with the program, I didn't have any other job. I was jobless, so I didn't have a choice. When Nature Conservancy came along, they advertised and they said they are looking for people that will be doing invasive species clearing in the catchment areas.
This is new for me, especially at the Nature Conservancy, because in the town that I am from, the only kind of jobs that we could do is farming or work in farms. So alien invasive plant removal was a new project for us.
Tendeka was hired as a contractor, charged with building a team of other women to join her up on the mountain.
I've got chainsaw operators, the people that are operating machines, ladies operating machines.
This idea of hiring women is not something that might occur to a lot of people.
Yes.
Are there some ways that you would rather have women on your team than men?
We do need men in our teams, but I prefer more ladies than men. I'm not like a feminist, but they are loyal. I don't want to lie to you. They are very loyal. Women are reliable. The people that can stand on anything are women, I promise you. And if things are getting tougher, you will stand with women. Most of them, they are single parents that are the heads of the houses. So even if somebody feels like I can give up, but who's going to assist him?
And so early in 2018, the work began to clear 250 square miles of invasive pines from the mountains of Cape Town. Now, there are no roads up into those mountains. The only way up there is by helicopter. The pilot flies each team high up into the mountains where they'll live and work for 2 weeks at a time. They set up these low, wind-resistant pup tents with solar panels to power the radios and the lights. The workers use clippers to snip away the baby invasive trees, chainsaws to cut down the ones they can walk to, and hand saws to cut the ones on steep slopes or sheer vertical walls. It was considered inadvisable for workers to mess around with chainsaws while hanging by ropes from the cliffside. The process begins with training, where Tandeka introduced prospective workers to the work they're signing up for.
It's sort of an orientation. You teach the person about the job from the beginning, and you do some awarenesses about like snakes, the steep areas that you are working, going to work on.
It sounded like you said snakes.
I did mention snakes because when you are working in the veld, there is snakes.
That word there is veld, V-E-L-D. It's the Afrikaans word for field. In this case, the work area is up on the mountain.
You must be aware that there will be snakes, and you must also be able to identify the snake, what kind of a snake that you saw, also how poisonous is the snake. Even if maybe somebody has been bitten by the snake, you must know what kind of snake was it.
And do you know what they teach them to do to a snake when they find one? Nothing.
You can't beat the snake because the snake belongs in the veld. That's where it belongs. You can't take anything from the veld, and you mustn't chase snakes as well.
Wow. So you teach them they're not allowed to hurt the snake?
No, they are not. They are not. We are conserving the nature because it's their territory. It's us that are coming to them in their own space.
Okay, well now, the good stuff. Tell me about the work.
Okay. All right. In the morning, the team leader or the crew leader will brief the people about the hazards on site and which area, then they will present their plan of how are we going to tackle the site. Then after that, they will put on their harnesses. It's a belt. And then they put on all the equipment on. And then the health and safety of the group will check each and every person before they go, that they've got everything with them, because it's safety, safety, safety all the time. Because those areas are very mountainous. They are very high. It's high areas.
And steep sometimes?
It's very steep, very steep.
Is it like a wall or is it more just like a...
No, it's like a wall. It's like a wall. It's like 5,000 feet from the sea level. It's 5,000 feet up. So just imagine, sometimes the ropes that they use, it's 200 meters going down.
So are you basically hanging from this rope?
Yeah. Like you can move around, but a little bit from this side to this side. And also, yeah, a little bit sideways, but not too much. Just like, for instance, you have a portion that you can clear, like maybe 2 meters. That's your area.
And is your heart just racing or are you used to that now?
When we started, the heights, some of them, they were afraid of heights. They are used to it now. Sometimes when they are waking, you'll even hear them singing.
Is it chainsaws? Is it handsaws?
In some areas where it's sort of, it's not that steep, they use chainsaws. Yeah. Otherwise, if the area is too steep, they do ring barking.
Ring barking is removing a band of bark from all the way around a tree, like a belt. Once you've ring barked a tree, it can't drink water anymore. You've basically cut its water intake pipes, and so it dies where it stands.
So, Asipe, when you're up there, can you give me a list of all the things you have to be careful of?
When you are in the mountain, first of all, you can get into a rock, and then you slip, and then you fall. It can be very hot that maybe one worker falls because of a dehydration. Also, you can be up there and then fire starts. And then there's no escape routes. that you will have to wait for the rangers to come and get you. And also, it sometimes happens that your chainsaw operator is busy cutting a tree. Then a worker is passing while the tree is falling, so they don't see it. Also, I can say maybe when one person is busy cutting a tree, and then they cut their fingers, like maybe just open a small cut, and then they start bleeding. There are reptiles up there, and there are other animals that are wild animals that can be scary. For example, there are baboons and stuff. Those are the things that happens up there.
Okay, I'm never going to complain about my job again. In 2020, the COVID pandemic slowed the Cape Town work, but only slightly. The teams cleared 90% of the area they'd targeted for the year. Now the work is getting back up to speed. But there have been other Day Zero crises in recent years. Cape Town's not alone. In 2008, the Spanish drought was bad enough that the city of Barcelona had to import water from France. In 2014 and 2015, Sao Paulo in Brazil, the biggest city in the Western Hemisphere, faced a similar crisis after a 13-month drought. The city had to shut off millions of residents' water for 12 hours a day. And Australia, of course, has been in more or less perpetual drought since the 2000s, which led to the devastating 2020 wildfires. Those fires killed over 3 billion animals and burned an area the size of Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Hawaii combined. That's why, in the last 20 years, the Nature Conservancy has set up similar green infrastructure projects in 40 cities around the world, producing more water, cleaner water, at a fraction of the cost of building gray infrastructure, and conserving habitats in the process. By the way, I have no connection to the Nature Conservancy other than being a fan. I just love the way they work. They come up with these environmental projects that operate within the system instead of against it. They devise ways to make it more profitable for stakeholders to conserve land and sea than to continue destroying it. From a water perspective, the Cape Town project has been a splashing success. And how much progress have you made so far? Can you see it?
Yes, because in some areas, when we started working there, you could see the area is a wetland, but it's dry. But now that we've cleared, it's damp now. You could see that there is a difference. It is damp. The water now are running down to the rivers, to the dams, to the rivers. Because also when there is invasive plants, they like to grow like together like this. Then the area is dense. So now the penetration of water, it doesn't go like easily. But now that they are cut down, then the water will penetrate easily.
And from a social and economic perspective, well, here's Tandeka to bring it all home. You spoke earlier about empowering women.
Yes.
Does it work? Do you see growing confidence? Do you see women earning a living?
Yes, I can see their confidence and also their leadership skills that I couldn't see before. Yeah, they've changed a lot. And also, like, they can afford other things that they couldn't afford before.
How about your life, Asipe? Any changes?
This program has changed me a lot, and also women in my town. For them, it's like a new life has begun. I've listened to them one day. They were planning what they're going to do, how they're going to achieve most of the things that they wanted in life. So this program really, really changed a lot of people's lives.
And the last question, how long will this go on? How long will you keep doing it?
No, at the moment, there is no end point. I will do it as long as I still can, like until I pension. And I'm mentoring other people so that it doesn't end with me.
Unsung Science with David Pogue is presented by Simon & Schuster and CBS News and produced by PRX Productions.
The executive producers for Simon & Schuster are Richard Rohrer and Chris Lynch. The PRX production team is Jocelyn Gonzalez, Morgan Flannery, Pedro Rafael Rosado, and the project manager is Ian Fox. The amazing Jesse Nelson composed the Unsung Science theme music, and fact checker Christina Ribello positioned herself nobly between my scripts and certain humiliation. For more Unsung Science episodes, visit unsungscience.com. And for more of my stuff, visit davidpogue.com or follow me on Twitter at Pogue, P-O-G-U-E. We'd love it if you'd like and subscribe to Unsung Science wherever you get your podcasts. And spread the word, would you? Thanks for listening.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.